for Wednesday, May 17th of 2017. And we start this morning's reading regarding a crime and courts situation. It states that a former girlfriend believes that Zimmerman is innocent. It's by Edith Brady Lundley, and it's in regards to the death of Pam Zimmerman in 2014. And it begins, Kirk Zimmerman's former girlfriend, who was with him around the time his ex-wife may have been killed, testified Tuesday that she believes he is innocent. Kate Arthur, who previously dated Zimmerman, gave details of her November 3, 2014 visit with the suspect who is charged with the murder in the death of Pam Zimmerman, age 53. Arthur said Zimmerman did not answer the door when she went to his Bloomington home shortly after 7 p.m. He asked her a short time later to return, and she stayed until around 9 o'clock, according to her testimony. Zimmerman, 58, told Arthur that he had laid down and was reading when she initially came to the door. First Assistant State's Attorney Adam Grist questioned Arthur for more than an hour during the pretrial hearing over whether the state will be allowed to introduce statements people claim they heard Pam Zimmerman make about her fears of her ex-husband before she was killed. When asked about her current relationship with Mr. Zimmerman, Arthur said she is a close friend and supports him and his family. She and Zimmerman had dated for 14 months before Pam Zimmerman's death, she said, adding that the two are no longer romantically involved. Arthur said her evening at Zimmerman's home was perfectly normal and included talking about the next day's election. Pam Zimmerman's body was found the following day in her Bloomington office. Police estimate she was killed early in the evening hours of November 3rd. Arthur said her evening, was perfectly normal, and she maintained that she had been honest with police and denied she deliberately deleted text messages to keep police from seeing her conversations with Kirk Zimmerman, saying it's her habit to daily delete electronic messages. She also was asked about a recorded jail call she had with Zimmerman in October of 2015 before he was released on bond. She denied telling Zimmerman, quote, we can just lie, end quote, during a conversation the two allegedly had about the legal protections available to spouses who does not want to testify against their partners. The contents of all of the call are expected to be discussed further on Wednesday after defense lawyer John Rogers has a chance to review a transcript of the call. Arthur acknowledged that she had discussed marriage with Zimmerman before and after his arrest. During their relationship, Zimmerman was very appreciative, considerate, and affectionate, said Arthur. Other testimony Tuesday included a conversation between Pam Zimmerman and a friend in the summer of 2013, in which she, Pam, recognized the potential danger of her former husband posed, according to a witness. Bob Rogers told Judge Scott Derkowitz about his warning to Pam Zimmerman that her ex-husband may pose a threat to her safety. Rogers said, I thought he could harm her badly. In her testimony, Rogers' wife, Susie Rogers, recalled her husband warning Pam Zimmerman to be careful. I think it's possible Kirk could snap and kill you. Bob Rogers said the cautionary remark was based on his gut feeling and intuition. He said Pam Zimmerman was a casual friend he knew through their children's softball teams. Bob Rogers said Pam Zimmerman responded matter-of-factly, "Don't you think I know that? I lived with him." The couple acknowledged that they did not report Pam Zimmerman's alleged comments to anyone until they were contacted by Bloomington police detectives in April of 2017. The Rogers are among about a dozen expected to offer statements, and that's printed in red. They allegedly heard in conversations with Pam Zimmerman late in her 20-year marriage to the suspect whom she was divorced in 2012. Rogers has vigorously objected to the statements as inadmissible hearsay. He disagrees that the state can use the statements under a legal provision that allows a victim's statements to be heard if it can be shown the suspect killed the person in order to keep them from testifying in court. Grist argued, and Grist part of the prosecution. Mr. Grist, who is part of the state's attorney's office, Tuesday argued that Zimmerman killed his former wife to keep her from coming to a future court hearing related to child support. And this hearing continues on Wednesday. So that's the local crime scene, and now we will move on to some political news about the City Eyes City Eyes existing civilian boards. As we end the article on the Zimmerman case, there are several photos that are listed. And also, if you go to thepantograph.com, you will find more pictures by David Prober. One is of Mr. Zimmerman's defense lawyer, John Rogers. The next is of Assistant State's Attorney Brad Rigdon, and also of Mr. Zimmerman's lawyer, John Rogers, talking with a former witness, Kathleen Kraft, who was the divorce lawyer for former Mrs. Zimmerman, Pam. And there are more photos if you're interested in having them described on the website. So now we'll move on to the Government and Politics City looking at civilian police review boards in other cities. This is by Maria Nagel. And it begins. Mayor Tari Renner and the City Council are gathering information about the kinds of civilian police review boards used by other central Illinois cities. Monday night, the council began discussing the idea after five community groups, Not Our Own, Not In Our Town, the ACLU, the NAACP, and the YWCA of McLean County, and Black Lives Matters of Bloomington Normal, asked for a citizen review board for the police. Renner said Tuesday the council probably will discuss the topic again at its June 19th committee of the whole meeting to see if there is a consensus on one of several potential types of review boards. The mayor states, "We want to involve the community and the police in deciding upon whatever kind of board we want to have." Renner said he envisions a group being called the Police Community Relations Board because there might be policy issues they might want to talk about, and it doesn't have to be focused on just complaints. Urbana has had a civilian police review board since 2011, and Mayor Diane Marlin views it as an effective tool to help bridge communication gaps between the police and community. Most Urbana's complaints come first to the police department, and the vast majority are handled by the police chief, she said. But if someone is not satisfied with that decision, or things are not resolved to people's satisfaction, then the Civilian Review Board acts as kind of another set of eyes and ears on the topic, said Marlin. I think it is valuable, she added. I think it also helps contribute to a better relationship between the community and the police department. Urbana's board acts in an appellate capacity when people request review of an internal police investigation. We have a hearing where we review the investigation conducted by the police department, Marlin said, and then we render our opinion and we share that opinion with the police chief. Since 2011, the board has conducted only two hearings, said H. Alex Bautista, Urbana's Director of Human Resources. Urbana's broad board consists of seven members appointed by the mayor with the approval of City Council. Members are chosen from diverse segments of the community and serve without compensation for a three-year term. In Springfield, Mayor Jim Langfelder is recruiting its seven-member Police Committee Review Commission, and it was established in 2005. The commission hasn't met in a couple of years because there weren't any cases to hear, said Springfield Deputy Mayor Bonnie Drew. The Springfield Commission operates similar to Urbana's in that it reviews internal police investigations of complaints about officers' conduct. We feel like our police department has very good rapport with the community, but it's not to say something might come up and we want to get our commission activated, said Drew. Champaign City staff at the City Council's direction is drafting an ordinance authorizing the creation of a subcommittee of the City's Human Relations Commission, whose members would assist with reviewing complaint investigations and providing recommendations to the Chief of Police. Champaign Deputy Police Chief John Swenson said subcommittee members would be able to review existing investigations completed by police command staff, but they would not have any role in the disciplinary process of any officer. The city's labor contract states only the police chief or the city manager can administer final discipline, said Swenson. Like Bloomington's union contract with its police force, Champaign's labor contract does not compel its police officers to testify before a civilian review board or subcommittee. The one in Champaign sounds like it might very well be a possible option for us, or some version of it, said Renner, Bloomington mayor. Obviously, ours has to be consistent with our police union contract. Renner also is questioning whether Bloomington's Board of Fire and Police Commissions, which has civilians appointed by the mayor and approved by the council, could be tasked with reviewing complaints filed against police officers. To me, that seems like a logical first step. Why reinvent the wheel? Said Renner. Right now, we have a minimal role in hiring. We could also maybe weigh in on policy issues of how we could perhaps diversify our public safety force. Nicole Albertson, Bloomington's Director of Human Services, said she sees nothing that would preclude fire and police commissioners from acting in that additional capacity. And that concludes our article on that local issue. Our final article on page one states, contradictions by Trump create credibility gap for AIDS assistance. Ken Thomas and Catherine Lucy of the Associated Press present this article. When the report burst forth alleging that President Donald Trump had revealed highly classified information to Russian diplomats, the White House quickly dispatched Trump's national security advisor to declare the story as reported as false. By the next morning, however, H.R. McMaster's prominent pronouncement was undercut by Trump himself, making the aide the latest to face public conflict with his boss in a White House where credibility problems are becoming an occupational hazard. Yes, the president said he had given information to the Russians, but there was nothing wrong with that, he insisted. In two tweets, Trump said the conversation with diplomats was an acceptable way to provide facts related to airline safety and terrorism, and he declared he had the absolute right to share the details. Still, the day after accounts prompted questions about McMaster's earlier comments on the story that were first reported by the Washington Post. These types of conflicts are a near constant in the Trump administration, which has tangled over accounts involving issues ranging from the size of Trump's inaugural crowd to the firing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Trump's claims that President Barack Obama wiretapped Trump Towers. Trump has frequently tasked aides and surrogates with delivering apparently false or misleading statements or to aggressively argue points that the president later contradicts. The conflicted information has made it harder for aides to effectively advocate for the president. It's always a hard job, but there's no question in my mind the president has made it harder for his immediate staff, which is there to support him, said Ari Fleischer, former press secretary to Republican President George W. Bush. Trump himself has raised doubts about the credibility of what his representatives say. He tweeted last week that since he is a very active president, it is not always possible for his surrogates to speak with perfect accuracy. He also suggested maybe the best thing to do would be to cancel all future press briefings and hand out written responses for the sake of accuracy. The White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer got off to a rocky start with beat reporters on the second day of the administration when he delivered a tirade about reporting on Inauguration Day crowds. Trump had already blasted the media over its reports, accurate about the numbers. Kelly Conway, counselor to the president, has also tangled with the media. Conway, the counselor to the president, tangled over the media about the believability of her statements when she said earlier this year at a television appearance that Flynn had Trump's full confidence hours before Trump fired him. She also referred to a, quote, Bowling Green massacre that never occurred. And Vice President Mike Pence insisted Flynn had not discussed Obama-era Russian sanctions with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. That was untrue, something that the White House blamed on Flynn when Trump fired him a month later. Asked Tuesday if he is concerned about the White House credibility being undermined, Spicer said no one would ever want that. But the loose accounting of facts has raised alarms among both Republicans and Democrats. They note that the administration has yet to face a national or international crisis comparable to the 9/11 2001 attacks or Hurricane Katrina or Sandy Hook shootings. Lacking credibility makes dealing with crisis infinitely more difficult, said Alex Conant, a Republican communications strategist who advised the presidential bid of Florida Senator Mario Rubio, a Trump rival. This White House has wasted credibility by arguing things like crowd size. This is not business as usual, and the president is truly creating chaos, said Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, in a speech Tuesday to the Center for American Progress Ideas Conference. The reliability of White House statements was again questioned after the firing of FBI Director James Comey last week and then in this week's intelligence flap. When Comey was ousted by Trump, the White House officials said the decision came only after the president consulted with Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his deputy Rod Rosenstein, who laid out a case for Comey's dismissal in a memo. But in an interview with Lester Holt 2 days later, Trump said he had long planned to sack his controversial FBI director. "I was going to fire Comey," Trump said. The White House made another pivot after Trump disclosed information about an Islamic State terror threat in his meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Kislyak. That disclosure included highly classified information, the Post reported. A senior U.S. official told AP the same thing, saying the threat involved laptop computers on aircrafts. The information had been shared with Trump by an ally, so his passing it along to Russia violated the confidentiality of an intelligence sharing agreement with that country, the official said. Hours after the story broke, McMaster stood in front of a bank of cameras saying that the Post story, as reported, is false. He added that at no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed, an allegation that was not made in the story, and that Trump did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. On Tuesday, McMaster said Trump's actions were wholly appropriate, adding the president wasn't even aware of where this information came from. He wasn't briefed on the source and method of the information either. For Trump staffers, there have been warnings they could be undercut by their boss. Trump, in a May 2016 tweet, offered this piece of advice: "Don't blame the biased and phony media quoting people who work for my campaign. The only quote that matters is a quote from me." That concludes our articles from page one, and now we move on to more local news, and it's an article about a freight train derailment in Elkhart. And so it begins with a photo by Kevin Barlow of railroad crews surveying the damage from a derailment of 18 cars in a 77-car train near downtown Elkhart Monday. Fortunately, there were no injuries reported, and all the roads and streets are now open. But here's the report by Kevin Barlow. "One of the worst things I have ever seen here. Rick Ingram was sure that a tornado hit the village of Elkhart late Monday night. I heard all of this noise of twisted metal and things crashing, and so I went outside, looked up, and saw the stars in the sky," he said. "I didn't know what was going on, but this is one of the worst things I have ever seen." Ingram, a village employee, made his way to the downtown area and discovered a freight train had derailed. "My first concern was if anyone was hurt and then if any possible chemicals were leaking," he said. Officials quickly determined there were no injuries and the only two cars carrying any type of hazardous chemicals were still upright and not involved in the 10:15 p.m. derailment. Eddie Rutherford said he lives a couple of blocks away, and crews that included 11 heavy-duty equipment units to clear the train cars arrived overnight to begin the cleanup process. There were still a lot of people out there just watching everything at 2 a.m., he said. Stuff like this doesn't happen very much here. The cause is still under investigation, and even though all cars have been cleared from the tracks, officials expect the cleanup to continue for several days. This is going to be one big scrapper special, said Doug Dischel, who drove from Carlock to see the cleanup operation. For Elkhart resident Gene Hickey, the scene was a little too familiar. Oh, I've seen this before because I'm a retired heavy equipment operator, he said, but I've never seen it down here in downtown Elkhart. Union Pacific, Illinois Commerce Commission, and the Federal Railroad Authority representatives met with cleanup contractors at the site on Tuesday morning. 18 rail cars on a 77-car train derailed, and there were no injuries to the train crew or the public and no hazardous materials involved in the derailment, said Union Pacific Railroad spokesman Callie Height. The train was hauling mixed freight. It originated in East St. Louis and was headed to Proviso outside of Chicago. The Logan County Emergency Agency was notified immediately, said Deputy Director Terry Storer. We arrived and determined that there were no chemical issues and closed the appropriate roads and made sure everyone was out of danger, he said. By 8:30 a.m. Tuesday, only four of the 18 derailed cars remained on the track. The rest were cleared by early afternoon. Derailed cars have been stacked between old Route 66 and the tracks. Train cars 13 through 31 were affected, some of which were carrying vehicles and transport, according to the Logan County EMA. Cars 55 and 56 were carrying isopropyl alcohol, and they remained upright and were quickly cleared. All roadway access into Elkhart are open, but Elkhart Fire Chief Jay Akers is requesting that travel be restricted when possible. Onlookers, please stay away, he said. There's a lot of heavy equipment. Farmers are asked to avoid bringing large equipment through town for a couple of days if possible. There will be no train traffic through the Elkhart area for an estimated 2 days, as there's approximately 100 yards of track that is unusable. We apologize for the inconvenience to the community and are working to safely and quickly clear the site and restore normal operations, Height added. Motorists should expect added delays at train crossings in downtown Lincoln due to passengers detraining to get on buses and trains turning around at Lincoln. And again, we have a photo here by Mr. Barlow. We have several of them showing the damage to the vehicles underneath the turned cars, and many of the vehicles were being transported, and just a very good thing that no one was injured. And on that note, we will take a short break and return for the second half hour of the Pantograph for Wednesday, May 17th, 2017. And please stay tuned. Thank you.